Well, good evening, fellow parents. How are you all doing? Good. My name is Ed Lee, and together with my wife, Jennifer, it is my privilege to welcome you tonight on behalf of the Cornell Parent Committee. Jennifer and I are very pleased and excited to begin our second term as members of this enthusiastic and dedicated group of parents. Our first was while our daughter, Kristen, attended the School of Human Ecology, graduating in 2012. Today, like all of you, we moved in our freshman, Austin, who will study in the College of Arts and Sciences. Although we both consider several other colleges and universities our alma maters, Jennifer and I can attest that Cornell has been a very special place and has a special place in our hearts. And we know it will for you as well. We have made many wonderful friends through our involvement with Cornell and have had amazing experience becoming a part of the Cornell family. We very much encourage you to get to know the campus, sit in on a class during Parents Weekend, and attend Cornell events in your hometown as you are now a member of the Cornell family. We as parents are an important part of life at Cornell, and I am pleased that all of you can be here with us tonight for our 9th annual Parent 101 event. We are fortunate that Susan H. Murphy, Vice President for Student and Academic Services, has joined us to talk about campus life and the experience we can expect to have as our children spend time at Cornell. Susan has served Cornell University as Vice President for Student and Academic Services since July 1994. A few of the offices under her direction are Academic Support Services, Campus Life Enterprises, Office of the Dean of Students, the Public Service Center, Athletics and Physical Education, Gannett Health Services, the University Registrar, and Cornell Career Services. In 1973, graduate of Cornell's College of Arts and Sciences, Susan majored in history. She subsequently completed her master's degrees at Stanford University and Montclair State College. In 1994, she earned her PhD in Educational Administration at Cornell. Susan joined the Cornell staff in 1978 following work as head of the Guidance Department at Cattenboro High School in Cattenboro, New Jersey. For 16 years, she worked in admissions and financial aid at Cornell, including 9 years as Dean of Admissions and Financial Aid. In addition to her current responsibilities at Cornell, Susan is a member of the Policy Committee of the Council of Ivy League Presidents. She has also served on many statewide and national higher education boards. Most importantly, Susan is the parent of two Cornelians, Sarah, class of 1986, and Julia, class of 1991, and is loved by all on campus. Please help me welcome Vice President Susan Murphy.
Ed, thank you very much. It's a delight to have you and Jennifer back with us on the Parents Committee. I appreciate especially your confidence in Cornell with now both children, first Kristen and now Austin here. And I will tell all of you that the Parents Committee is a wonderful partner with us in student and academic services, particularly with the Parents Fund. They have given us the margin of excellence where we can respond to all those creative ideas your students will come up with that we weren't smart enough to put in the budget or allow us to invest in our strategic priorities. So I really appreciate it. And I am delighted to welcome all of you here tonight on a very special night, I know. I can imagine if you feel like I did, even as a stepmom, when the girls came off to college, that you're a mixture of emotions. So this hour is going to be for you. You will not, I hope, get text messages or calls from your Cornellian They should be meeting with a resident advisor and their hallmates so they are cared for. You don't need to worry about them. So I want you to sit back. I want you to relax. I want you to take a deep breath and remember to exhale. And we're going to talk a little bit about what it is that your sons and daughters are about to experience, what I anticipate you may be experiencing, and what we have here as a set of resources for all of you. My recollection of a day like today is sort of like that first day of kindergarten, or the first time your son and daughter got in a car, if they drive without you, or if you live in a city and you sent them off on public transportation and you weren't with them. You're proud as can be of their readiness for this. You're nervous as all get out, whether they're going to find their way to where they're supposed to be. So you're worried, but you're also confident because you know what you've given them for the last 17, 18, 19, or 20 years. I'll bet a few tears have been shed, and a few more will likely be shed before the weekend is out. And you know what? All of that's perfectly normal because this is a big milestone. This is a time when that son and daughter, that child, is going to leave you as what we call an emerging adult, and we hope will come out the other end as a full adult. Legally, they are adults if they're 18. In my 20, now almost 21 years working with them, I know they're not quite there yet in making all of the decisions, but we're going to talk about some of the challenges that makes. So if you're feeling that mixture of emotions, I want to just suggest that if you have younger brothers and sisters at home, although they probably won't articulate it, they're going to be feeling the very same emotions. And as those who know me well, as an absolute dog lover, if you have dogs or cats at home and they are particularly attached to your Cornelian, they're going to wonder what's going on when you get home. So my advice is to take a T-shirt with you or a smelly sock or something from here and take it home with you. So at least the dog and cat will know that they're still around and that they'll be back. And you'll laugh now, but I'll bet at Thanksgiving you'll say, you know what? She was right. Because the animals, particularly if they've been sleeping in the bed of the Cornelian, are really going to wonder what has happened. So, here we are at the essentially isolated place that we call Ithaca. If you've had to travel afar, I congratulate you for getting here. We have wonderful air service if you like to go to Detroit and Newark and Philadelphia. If you have any connection with New York City, you'll discover our campus-to-campus bus is frankly one of the easiest and best ways to get back and forth. It has Wi-Fi and food, and it just goes from here to our campus locations in New York. It's more efficient than a plane. But here we are in this very special community that we call Cornell. And I hope as your son or daughter explored universities, you got to know us a little bit, and through these next couple of days, you'll get to know us even better. We did and have created an orientation program for you, and that's intentional because there are some things that we think are important for parents to know. You'll note your book is not quite as long as the students. That's not because we don't value you as much, but it is because we think it's probably time for you to go home on Saturday night or Sunday morning so that they can begin to get ready for being here on their own. We're not kicking you off the campus. If you want to stay longer, you're welcome to do that. But sometimes, as the students will tell us, it's very helpful, Vice President Murphy, that your parents' orientation program ended Saturday night, because I looked at my mom and dad and said, your program's done. Don't you think you ought to go home? And it just facilitates that beginning of a separation. If you are rightly feeling a little proud about your kid, you deserve to. You may have heard these numbers, and I know you'll probably hear them again. Your sons and daughters emerged from an applicant pool for our first-year class of 43,000 students. Now, as someone who has the privilege of a Cornell degree, I will tell you that my degree is just getting more valuable each year because it was no way near that selective back when I applied, and here I am. You know what year I graduated. I told you I'm in class of 73, so way back in the dark ages, before the Common Application and all the things you can do electronically, it was a much smaller number. So it's much more difficult to get in these days. Of those 43,000 applicants, we have 3,260 joining us as first-year students. We managed this year to get every state but North Dakota. Last year, I was saying we had every state but Wyoming and Arkansas. So we figured out Wyoming and Arkansas, but we missed North Dakota. I spent about half of a week as part of a tour this summer in South Dakota and made the mistake I discovered to the South Dakotans of talking about the Dakotas being all one and very similar. And boy, do the South Dakota people don't think that North Dakota is at all like them. So I need to go to North Dakota now. It's one of the states I've never visited to figure out why that is. So we're missing North Dakota, but we have the District of Columbia, Puerto Rico, the Virgin Islands, and 51 countries just in the first year class. There are something like 120 countries represented on this campus. So while we call ourselves centrally isolated, really we are the world that has come here to Ithaca, and that's part of what makes it so special. If you are a Cornellian yourself, the campus will look different, not just physically, but among the student body. This year's class is 51% women. When I was here, it was less than a third women. So it's changed dramatically. 43% of our entering students will identify as a student of color, African American, Native American, Asian American, or Latino. So it's a very diverse community. And for our students, that mixture is a richness, but sometimes can be a challenge, because some of your sons and daughters have gone to high schools in a community that's much more homogeneous than this is. It's a heterogeneous economic community. It's an heterogeneous religious community here, which I'll talk about in a bit, and ethnically and experientially. That's what we think is part of what makes Cornell so exciting. But if you've not lived in that heterogeneity, you sometimes can stumble because you just are not familiar with different traditions, different customs, different languages. And we try to help educate all of our students about our different communities, and we also try to help them remember to, as I said to our students in our note, to know the power of their words, to learn to be sensitive. And if you say something that is offensive, don't automatically assume that that was intended to be offensive, but to let people know, gosh, I wish you hadn't said that, and here's why. And that's how that education begins. So it's an incredibly rich community of experiences and backgrounds. Part of that richness comes from the very different intellectual paths our students will follow here. Unlike our Ivy peers, that group we compete with in an athletic conference, our students here have 100 different majors to choose among, and they will find, as you well know now, their academic home in one of seven of the undergraduate schools and colleges. And so that's one of the many ways we try to help make this community of 22,000 students, undergraduate and graduate, feel smaller. They will begin to identify where their college, in some of the colleges right from the beginning, like in agriculture and life sciences, they'll start by identifying with their major, and that begins to give them an anchor. Now, it doesn't mean that they're stuck there. They clearly can and will be asked to take courses across a range of disciplines as part of their fulfilling distribution requirements to get a breadth of education. They can have minors as well as double majors, and they can make different choices. We certainly have students, many hundreds of students, who will start in one college and graduate in another. And sometimes it takes a little bit of a circuitous path. It's not guaranteed, because you have to prove to the new college that you have the academic interest and the preparation to do that, but that happens on a regular basis. So if you have a child who has come here and they want to be an economics major in arts and sciences, and all of a sudden they discover we have a school of hotel administration, which they'd never heard about, and they want to take that economic interest and make it into a business interest with a focus on hospitality, That's okay. Don't freak out about it. Actually, that's one of the very exciting things that we think will happen at Cornell. It's also an institution that, as you'll come to appreciate, I hope this year, that has a very interesting history, because we truly are a private university with a public interest. From the day we were founded by Ezra Cornell, who gave us his farm, this lovely piece of property in upstate New York. We have also been the land-grant university for the state of New York, which has meant that we have had a commitment to share the research and expertise that happens here on the campus with the community, and also to be connected with the community to understand what are the issues of the community that should be informing our scholarship and our teaching. And that back and forth between the public and the university is something that has been in our DNA, something we will celebrate a lot in this sesquicentennial, and something that I hope that you'll come to understand and appreciate, as will your sons and daughters. This is the year of our 150th birthday, and we're going to have a few birthday parties along the way. Not to overdo it, but to take the Cornell message out to our alums and parents literally around the world. We'll be doing a celebration in Hong Kong and in London, as well as New York and on the West Coast, here in the fall, and then again in the spring when we're going to be celebrating what's called Charter Day, the actual signing of the university charter. And if you can find a hotel room in Ithaca that weekend, I invite you to come join us. It should be a great academic symposium in April, and we will be engaging with your students as well and including them as part of the activity. So it's a wonderfully rich community with lots of intellectual challenge. One of the realities that I laugh with the students, particularly as we get to around to the first exam, is to ask how many of them, first of all, how many of them come from a high school that don't rank? And now about half the students come from high schools that have never ranked. Those who come from high schools that rank, if you ask them, the vast, vast, vast majority, like 90%, come from the top 10% of their high school. That's the level of competition. Then I say, well, now how many of you think you're going to be in the top 10% when you graduate? Because last time I checked, only 10% of you in this room are going to be in the top 10% of your class. Now, we make it a little easier because we have 7 colleges, so we can have 7 top 10%. But that's one of the realities our students, you know, this funnel has just gotten a lot narrower. And they need to develop an internal barometer about how well they're doing, not just an external barometer of how well they're doing, because they're not all going to be in that top 10%. But we believe, and our statistics will tell us, they will succeed. 92-93% of our students graduate in 6 years. That's the official graduation that the government tracks. Probably in the high 80s are graduating in 4 years, and then some take a little bit longer. Those who don't graduate, the number who don't graduate because of academic reasons is frankly teeny tiny. The ones who do other ones, they've had a change of family circumstance, a change of major, a change of experience. So we believe when we say to them, you will succeed here. Now, if they don't go to class, they don't do their homework, they make some bad decisions, which we both hope they won't make, they might take a little bit of a side path. But I want you to have confidence to share with them that they're going to succeed, even if it's not going to be at that top 10%. Now, I will admit, as I continue in my comments, as Ed shared, I have a huge bias about this place. I have my own undergraduate degree and my graduate degree. My husband earned his doctorate through the employee degree program before I did. And I have 2 daughters, Sarah and Julia. It's fun having 2 kids who go through here, because if you were to interview Sarah and Julia, you would have no idea they went to the same university. Sarah came to Cornell, and if I were to put together a prototypical, stereotypical college experience, freshman year in Dixon, she happened to have one of the few non-singles, she's still friends with her roommate, sophomore year in the sorority, junior year she did Cornell in Washington for one of the semesters, senior year she lived off campus, she played in the orchestra, she dated a fraternity guy, didn't marry him, married somebody who went to the University of Alabama, something I still don't quite understand. But we have a lot of fun, as you can imagine, talking about football, the Ivy League versus the University of Alabama. I adore my son-in-law, but that's one topic we don't talk much about. So Sarah Grad came in and went through in 4 years. So 2 years later, Julia comes along. Julia starts, actually, back then we had some options to start in January. She started in January in the College of Human Ecology, studying human development, and after 1 semester said to her father, I'm done. I don't know what I want to do in college. I'm not going back to school. I'm the stepmom, so I just sort of nod my head and figure this is for dad and daughter to work their way through. And for 2.5 years, she followed The Grateful Dead. With Michael number two in her life. There was Michael number three, then there was Mark. But Michael, this was Michael number two. Michael was a high school dropout, but he was an entrepreneur, made tie-dye everything. Sold tie-dye everything, as they lived out of their bus while they followed The Grateful Dead. And I just thought, you know, I better stay away from the telephone because I'm sometimes known in my family as Susie 20 Questions. You know, I've got a million questions, and this was not question time. And older sister Sarah just kept saying, Dad, just keep listening. You know, she's calling home to check in, just keep listening. And lo and behold, one day she decided she wanted to come back to school. She wanted to go back to school. So she went to a community college where she was living in rural Pennsylvania. Then she wanted to come back to Cornell for summer school. I thought that was just to prove to her older sister that she too could do Cornell work. Turns out she came back to Cornell full time. And even more surprising, she lived at home for a year. Because when she came back, she wanted to change majors. She was going from human development to creative writing. She had to get her grades where they needed to be. And when we said, where do you want to live? Because she was clear she wasn't going to live in a residence hall after you followed The Grateful Dead for 2.5 years. This very contemplative kid looks at her dad and then looks at me, and she said, can I live at home with you guys for a year? So she is the class of 91, even though she started, you know, 7 years before that, and is a very proud Cornelian, but she never stepped foot in Sholkoff Stadium until the day she graduated. She lived off campus and in one of our co-ops and had just an entirely different but equally special Cornell experience. So my reason for telling you that, aside from being very proud of my two girls, who are also the moms of my grandchildren, is to say there are many paths through Cornell. You may have one in mind for your son and daughter, and my guess is you've talked about that, at least I hope you have. They may end up taking a different one, perhaps not as radical as Julia's, but they may take a different path. And as parents, you know, that sometimes can be among the most challenging things for us. It's what we want our children to do. We want them to be independent. We want them to go their own way. But if we've had a direction for them, it can be sometimes difficult to give them that flexibility. And I just encourage you to do that. Above all else, let them know you love them and you trust them and you will, you know, walk with them. But you may find that they're going to end up in a slightly different direction than you had anticipated. You know, I think that one of the major changes that's likely to occur in these next 4 years, particularly if this is your first child to go to college, you have been for many years the chief decision maker at home. And over the last couple years, you've loosened those reins, I suspect. But now you're not going to be here making all those decisions. With technology, they're likely to call you still to ask for that decision because it's so easy. Anyway, I'm old enough that we did the Sunday night when the rates were cheap calls to home, and a lot had happened over the course of, you know, the previous Sunday to the next Sunday that we had just had to figure our way out. In today's world, they are going to be on the phone to you. And I hope it's mostly they to you. You should check in with them, and I hope that with all seriousness, one of the conversations you're going to have with them is kind of what do you expect about regular communication? You know, are you expecting to hear from them on a daily basis? I might suggest that that may not be necessary. Maybe in the beginning, yes, but over the long haul, maybe not. But that might be your family tradition. But if you're expecting to hear from them weekly and you haven't heard from them, then, yeah, you need to be in touch. But when they call and say, Mom, what do I do? Or, Dad, how do I fix this? I hope you begin to master the question back to them as opposed to just the answer. Because that's one of those big transitions that we want to work with you, and we're going to be working equally as hard to be a guide, to be a support, to be a challenge to them, But if they've just come out of their faculty advisor's office to talk about the curriculum for next year, and they've spent an hour with that faculty advisor, and they call you to talk about it, very important conversation. But the expertise about that curriculum probably sits more with the faculty advisor than it may sit with you. And so trying to find that way of being that guide, being that support, and not just the answer giver. So part of what we hope we can do is put in your hands and give you the knowledge about where are those resources, because you may need to help direct them to where the resources are, but not just be the easy answerer, because quite frankly, they're never going to figure out how to make those decisions themselves if they don't try. And this is a pretty safe environment for them to begin to figure that out. It's a little bit how we think about our role as well. Yesterday, I sent a message out to all of our students, our returning students as well as our new students, and suggested to them as they get ready to start the school year that there are three things that I hope they will think seriously about doing. And this is a message especially for the first-year students, but also for our upper-class students. One is to make connections and get involved. So, all of your sons and daughters were enormously involved in something in high school. They may have worked, they may have been involved in music, they may have been involved in the religious community. Probably they were involved in several things. Now they're here, and the worry is going to be, do I only focus on my academics this first semester? Because that's why I'm here and I'm a little nervous about it. Well, of course that's their priority. But I would encourage them to find a thing beyond their academics to get involved with. Because we all need to take a break from that intellectual challenge to just kind of let some of that learning set in. It might be that they're going to become a fitness fanatic. It might be that they're going to find a club. It might be Hillel. It could be the Catholic community. Some of them have already started with Cornell Outdoor Education or the Public Service Center. Whatever it might be, I'm not going to put a value judgment. You may have some suggestions, but I hope they will get involved in a thing, not 20 things, but at least a thing, and that they make a conscious effort to connect. Connect with their roommate, connect with their floor mates, connect with their resident advisor, connect with their faculty advisor. For some of our students, making new friends, this will be the first time they've had to do this since they were 5 years old and went to kindergarten. And they may not even know how they went about making their best friends. For other students, they've done this before. You guys have moved them around, so they've had to make friends in new communities, or they've gone off to a different place in the summer, or they've gone away to school, so the making new friends is something they have experience with. But for others, it's actually something they have to figure out. And it's hard to know with those acquaintances they make right in the beginning are going to be their good friends or they're just going to be acquaintances. And helping them understand, we start with acquaintances and eventually you're going to find that friend group, I'm convinced. We ask them, as I mentioned earlier, to respect one another. Because this is, as I said earlier, just a community from very different traditions. And you only have to look at the world around us, including our own country, to know there's lots of reasons to have conflict points. And we have all those same reasons here. No doubt this fall we're going to end up in arguments about what's going on in the world around us, whether it's in the Middle East or it's in the Ukraine. There are going to be issues around what's happened in Missouri. And our students are going to take positions on those issues. And what we say to them is, of course you're going to disagree, but we want you to disagree about ideas, not be disagreeable. And that's a learned skill as well. Sometimes I'm still working on it. So we have a group of students who created a program that I'm very supportive of and hope we will even expand, called To Know the Power of Your Words, and to help our students understand, I'm of the generation that my mother told me, sticks and stones will break your bones, but names will never hurt you. But we now know names can be very hurtful. And so we need not to do that, certainly intentionally and hopefully not unintentionally. And then, this is a community where you want to reach out. We want to reach out into the Ithaca community. We want to reach out across our faculty, staff, and students. And one of the things that I think I ask your help with and ours as well is to help these new Cornellians learn to ask for help. They're very accomplished. A lot of them are pretty type A in their personality, and they think they've got it down pat. And they think it's a sign of weakness if they have to go ask for help about writing, or help how to figure out their schedule, or help on computers, or help with their mental health, or help with their physical health. And the message we convey again and again is learning to ask for help is a sign of strength. And so there's nothing wrong with that. So when they're struggling with that economics exam or that chemistry first exam, there are resources here, whether it's supplemental instruction or faculty office hours or graduate TAs or tutors who can help. And there's actually a good thing to be asking for that. So encourage them to learn to ask for help. As I mentioned, you often are going to be the first point of contact. One of the huge changes with this generation is when if you asked my generation, where did you turn? We said our friends. Then we might have said the people on the campus, and our parents were probably last. Now they'll say friends and parents almost equal. So you're a very important part of their world, and that's terrific. But it is then that learning how to guide. And know as well that you're likely to hear sometimes when things aren't going quite as well, more often than you will hear when things are going well. The classic will be they take the chemistry exam, they call you as they're walking out, and they say, I've just flunked it. I didn't know half the questions. This is impossible. I studied like crazy. I'm done. It's not going to work. Then they're going to get their exam back, and it might have a number they've never seen before, 30 or 40. And then they'll forget to tell you that chemistry is one of the departments on campus that curves their grading, and that might have been a B+. So you're in this panic mode about, they've thought they failed when they took the exam, they aren't sure about the grade, they forget to tell you the good news. So make sure you get the whole story. That's just from the personal experience of how it works. Let me just touch briefly, before we open it to questions and answers, on some topics that we talk about for our parents. I hope all of you receive the family guide. That's one of our resources. It also has some others. As you came in, and they'll still be there as you go out, we have this book that Dean Hubbell, our Dean of Students, led the creation of this wonderful document a year ago. It's called Voices, Stories of Insight and Experience. It is not meant to be read from front to back. It's a little daunting in doing that. But it's a resource with essays from faculty, from staff, from advisors, from the president, from Greek life, student activities. And so this is a wonderful resource, and I hope you'll take one as you leave. And what we've tried to do is talk about some of the topics that are often issues that come up in our first-year students' experience that you may hear about. So one is the roommate. Vast majority of our first-year students have roommates. My guess is most of your children have not shared even a bathroom, let alone a bedroom. So now we're putting him in 220 square feet with a stranger, with more stuff, if I looked at your cars today, than it can possibly fit. And we say, make nice for the year. And the vast, vast, vast majority will end up in wonderful situations. Some of them will become best friends for life. Most of them become friends, but they may go different paths. Occasionally, the match just does not work. Sometimes there are issues with roommates. They could be lifestyle issues, or they could get more complicated, like boyfriends and girlfriends being in the room. If it's just we're not getting along, our practice is not to change roommates for at least the first couple of weeks, unless something absolutely horrible is going on. Because our experience tells us some of the we're not getting along is just trying to figure out how do you get along with somebody that you're sharing a space with. And that's just a helpful life skill, because you may be spending your life with somebody else sharing a room as you get older. call the partner or a spouse. So, hopefully they practice a little bit on their college roommate how to get along. But if you have a sense that the living situation is getting in the way of good health for your student, then it's time to say something. And we will do our best to make an accommodation. Right now, we don't have a lot of extra beds. Everyone's in a bed and in a room, but we don't have a lot of maneuverability. So in those first week or so, if you know, they haven't made a best friend with their roommate, and their roommate's a pit, you know, if my daughters were roommates, one sorts her socks by color, the other one looks like Pigpen. And they didn't ever live in the same room because it was World War III. But that's a classic thing where they need to learn how to develop a contract about what's the agreement, about how they're going to share their space, and figure that out. And we will give them some tools to do it. I already talked about that first exam. Our students are confident today. They'll be confident through the beginning. Then they'll get a little nervous on that first exam, and they'll wonder, did they really get the right letter? And as I said to you, they did. And remind them that if they all came out with A pluses after their first exam, where would they have to go? So they'll be challenged a bit, and then they'll end up progressing. We've also talked about the issue of academic program. If you do have really clear ideas about what you hope your son and daughter is doing, I hope you've at least talked about that and talk about how different pathways, so that it's not a surprise when there is a different discussion to be had. We will talk to them a lot about academic integrity issues. The vast majority of our students come to us with great skills in that area, but this is one of the ways where our world, our being a population of people from around the world, rules are different in different cultures, and so we need to educate our students about what is the American culture of sharing information and not sharing information. We're going to give them a book called The Essential Guide to Academic Integrity and how to cite sources and how to use the internet appropriately. So that, as you can imagine, in an academic institution, something that we consider to be very important. I want to talk a little bit just about physical health and mental health. Because chances are, in the time of 4 years, something's going to happen. They're going to get a sore throat. They're going to break a finger. They're going to ask you, should they get a flu shot? The answer is yes, please get flu shots. Keeps our campus much healthier. It could be something more serious. We have 24-hour access to both physical and mental health by phone. We have a clinic here on campus that is open Monday through Friday in the evenings for some appointments and on Saturday as well. But there's always a doctor or a nurse 24/7 at the other end of the phone for you to call or for them to call. We're going to ask them increasingly to manage their health. If they're 18, it gets a little complicated by legal rules, where we can't talk to you about them unless it's life-threatening, unless they've given us permission. We often ask them when they come to us, will they sign a release? But that's a very important conversation for you to be having with your kids before you go home, about signing releases and making sure you have access to information. And this is not a Cornell rule. This is the HIPAA rule. It governs the hospital. It governs us as well. As I mentioned, if we ever think it's life and death, we're going to call and then we'll deal with the legal issue afterward. But if your son or daughter gets taken, let's say they make a bad decision and drink too much alcohol, and they even end up at the hospital with too much alcohol, but it's not life-threatening, we may not call you that first time. We will no doubt call you or have them be in touch with you, the student, the second time, and we'll call you the third time. And that's just not on transport. That's our alcohol policy. So if a student violates our alcohol rules, 21 is the drinking age, so if they violate that rule and are caught, and it's not serious, the first time we'll put them in an educational program. It's called Basics. The second time, they're dealing with the dean of students, as well as the judicial administrator, and the dean of students is going to suggest they call you before he sends you a letter, because we think it's better that they tell you as opposed to us telling you. And then the third time, we're going to be on the phone to you, because if we see three alcohol issues, that to us is a proxy that we have a dependency issue, and we want to try to address that sooner than later. happens with very few of our students, but it's a serious issue that we want to try to nip in the bud. So alcohol is one of those topics that you, I hope, have been talking to your kids about all through high school. It's one of those shared conversations we're going to have, because you're not going to have them under, you know, your watch day and night, and we're not going to be checking on them every moment of the day either. We don't go into their freshman residence hall rooms to see what's going on unless there's a reason for us to do that. Noise, concern around health, we consider their rooms to be their private spaces. So those are important conversations to be had. Stress is another very important topic to talk about. What are their ways of dealing with stress? What are your ways of dealing with stress? For me, it's my dog. Some nights I go home and we play the silliest game of hide-and-go-seek in the house. It's great for her because it exhausts her. It's how I let go of tension. And it's a social, you know, it's somewhat a socially acceptable way. The other way I do it is I go to hockey games and I scream my lungs out on a Friday night, as Dale will know. More on Friday night than I do on Saturday night, because that's just how I deal with the stress that naturally builds up in the nature of this job. So one of the things we want our students to figure out is how do they deal with the stress? You know, the stress of being away from home, the stress of new relationships, what are their physical activities for doing it, what are their good eating habits in doing that, are they getting enough sleep? Are they finding resources of people to talk to, their friends, their RA? We have a terrific counseling staff of professional therapists here on campus that they have access to. So again, you'll be able to tell on the phone, you know, is this just kind of natural stress, or is this something I need to worry about, and what are the resources that are available? And then by all means, if there is a serious illness, if your son or daughter is coming to us with a pre-existing condition, whatever it may be, I hope you have made connection with the medical staff at Gannett. We would like to make those connections as early as we can, get them connected with a physician, if it's physical health, or with a therapist if it's mental health. If it's an ongoing condition, that's not going to go away just because they moved here to Ithaca. And so let's get connected to the resources that we have. There are also wonderful resources in the chaplains. Cornell United Religious Work is an amalgam of about 30 different religious communities. They are huge partners with us in working with our students and in developing a sense of community. And that's another resource that I hope that you will call on. So the resources that your son and daughter have, they have their resident advisor who are well-trained students. They have professional staff as residence hall directors in their residence halls. Virtually every freshman residence has a faculty in residence and faculty fellows. So there are lots of concerned adults that are around that community. They all have a faculty advisor. They also have college advising offices. So if they are having trouble connecting with their individual advisor, they can go to the advising office and they can make a connection there. There are staff in the Dean of Students office. So there are many, many resources, and they are here for you as well. We also will push out to you once a month a parent's newsletter. Many of you may have already seen it. And if you didn't, I hope you will subscribe by writing to parents@cornell.edu. And it's where we try to collect a bunch of information and send to you on about a monthly basis, as well as the guides that I suggested for you to take a look at. So as we welcome the class of 2018 in this sesquicentennial year, I hope that you will work with us as we work with them to have them get involved as Cornell students, to get to know at least one faculty member well enough each semester so that that faculty member could write a letter of recommendation for them. And I say to the students, I will tell the students that every time I can this week, and even if they only pay attention to me half the time, they're going to still end up with four faculty members who can write on their behalf. And that can be important for summer internships, let alone grad school or full-time jobs. I hope they will stretch themselves beyond their comfort zone. Many of them have already done that just by coming to Ithaca, New York. I know some of them did it during the Outdoor Odyssey, As I was there last night with all students who came back from the camping trip, I met a number of students who'd never been hiking or camping a day in their life, and they had just finished 6 days of it, and I said, you can check off getting out of your comfort zone. They will learn to swim while they are here. It's one of Cornell's odd requirements. They must take PE for a year, and they must pass their swim test. And if they've already passed their swim test, they've fulfilled one graduation requirement. So they should feel great about that. I will tell you on the day before graduation, I can't tell you how many swim tests we are still administering. So that is one of the questions you're allowed to ask. Have you taken your swim test? And if they don't pass or they don't know how to swim, we're going to teach them how to swim. That's what they will do for PE. And I guarantee you, they'll learn how to swim. Now, just because they know how to swim, the one place that I do get out of my guide and support mode into my tell mode has to do with our gorges. Not just the gorges campus, our gorges, G-O-R-G-E-S. The Ice Age left us with the most beautiful cuts in the earth. It is illegal to swim in the gorges. Worse, it is dangerous. And particularly with the rain that we have had these past weeks, as you're watching the mist on the bridges, if you went back and forth from North Campus to Central Campus. Sadly, we have lost students who went swimming in the gorges. So that's the one message I'm unequivocal about, do not. And not because it's illegal, because that just goes right over their head. It's life-threatening, and I really need your help. And if you are a Cornellian yourself, you will be the worst, because you probably went swimming in the gorges when you were a student here. And so you'll say, but I did it, so please, on that one, it's sort of a no fooling, no joke. They're wonderful to look at. They're great hiking trails through them. You can sit on the edge. We want you to experience them. We just don't want you in the water. So your students are coming to this incredible community. They're going to make fabulous friendships. They're going to connect with some of the best minds in the world on the faculty and among their fellow students. They will stretch their own comfort zone, and I'll leave you with just the thought that one of our colleagues who's a faculty member in English, Dan Schwartz, who does a Huffington blog, and he's now done several years about 10 suggestions for incoming college freshmen. Started out with 10, he's actually up to number 19. I'm only going to read you one. It says, remember the three R's, and he's not here talking about reading, writing, and arithmetic. Resilience. Falling down and getting up are one motion. Second one is resourcefulness. Use your skills and your intelligence. And the third R he wants the students to remember is resolve, to pursue their goals with determination and persistence. So if we succeed in helping our students, your sons and daughters, to develop resilience, leave here being resourceful human beings and with a resolve to make a difference in the world, as we know they're capable of doing and will do, then we will believe we have accomplished our mission in giving them a wonderful education, and I hope you will agree with us at that point. So thank you very much for being with us. We do have a few minutes. I know it's been a very long day, so we're not going to stay for questions and answers long, although I'll stay as long as people want. But for some joint Q&A, I'm happy to answer things that you wished I'd talked about that I didn't. So we'll see who's going to be first, or questions of things that were not clear, or just things you have not had answered yet today.
I did have a question in regards to something you did mention. You mentioned out of the 43,000 applicants, around 3,200 were accepted.
Are enrolled.
Enrolled. Okay, that's the clarification I need.
Yeah,
Thank you.
We accepted about 6,000, so we enroll about half of the number that accept, and they have some wonderful choices. Who's going to be the brave soul of anyone? There are microphones, or if you raise your hand, we can get you a microphone. Okay.
Can you talk about sophomore housing?
Can I talk about sophomore housing? Yes, I can. I'd be happy to. Sophomore housing, we guarantee our sophomores housing on campus as long as they apply on time. We have probably about 40 to 45% of our sophomores who are living in what I would call residence halls. So that would mostly be on West Campus in the houses, could be in the theme-based houses, or could be in some residence halls in college towns, Cascadilla, Sheldon Court, or Schuyler House. We also have a fraternity and sorority system where students can go through the process of recruitment in the spring semester of their first year, but they do not move into a fraternity or sorority until the fall of their sophomore year. And about 30% of our students choose a fraternity or sorority as an option. They don't have to live in necessarily, although some chapters do expect that. They also can choose among what we call cooperatives. Like I was saying, my daughter Julia was in a co-op. So as for sophomore year, if I look at people who are in fraternities, sororities, program houses, the West Campus houses, traditional halls, we probably have about 80% of our students in some form of campus-based housing. Students may choose to go off campus, and that's their option. You will hear from landlords this week, sign up for a lease now. If you don't sign up now, there won't be any good housing next year. Don't have them sign leases. Don't even have them sign leases at fall break if you can have them hold on. Because frankly, they just don't know people well enough yet about who they want to live with. But in the junior and senior year, we do not guarantee them housing. I want to be quite upfront about that. Many of our students are studying abroad, studying in New York, studying in Washington, but the tradition here is that they are beginning to move off campus. We do have some juniors on campus, both as resident advisors and in our what we call continued occupancy opportunities. But sophomores, they're guaranteed housing on campus. They don't hear that message, but join us in preaching it. Yes, ma'am. Have we come across any instances of hazing? Sadly, the answer to that is yes. It's an issue that we have taken very seriously here on the campus, and we actually have a website called hazing.cornell.edu. I wanted to call it nohazing.cornell.edu, but the students convinced me they wouldn't go look at a nohazing.cornell.edu. So it's actually been used as a national resource. It's a way students, we're trying to educate them about how to build bonds without hazing, what hazing is, and it's also a way that they can report confidentially if they have experiences. Hazing is illegal by our campus code. It's illegal in New York State. So if you were found guilty of it, you could be dealing with a criminal system as well as our system. Our most recent, last year I ended up suspending a fraternity because of hazing. They were on probation and it didn't stop. And you may have heard last fall we suspended our lacrosse team for some hazing involving alcohol. So that's another one of those very important conversations. We say to our students, our newer students, you should tolerate none of that. There's no place for it. We know we have work to do to help students learn how to build bonds without doing it in a demeaning way. We're not the first time many of our students have experienced hazing, sadly. When you ask them about experiences that we would classify as hazing, have you ever experienced this? Vast majority have already experienced that in high school. They don't often label it hazing, though. So it's something that our president is a national spokesperson about. We've created a campus-wide council that is looking at hazing because it's not just in the Greek system. It happens in athletic teams. It happens in other groups. We have ROTC participating with us in that, and they've been actually a very helpful resource as the military has changed a lot of their ways of indoctrinating different new members. So it's a very important topic. I wish I could tell you we've gotten rid of it, but I would be disingenuous if I did that. But we have a pretty, as in zero, tolerance for it. Yes, sir?
How can you get involved with the Cornelian Parent Coalition? How can you find out information?
How can you find out about the Parents Committee, Deb Hurley? Can you help me answer that question?
For those of you that are interested, I would encourage you to reach out to Penny Chick in the development department, or you can reach myself at dlh242@cornell.edu. That would be a resource that's available. We would welcome your participation.
So Penny Chick or Deborah Hurley are the two names you might be interested in. And as was mentioned earlier, you know, as parents of Cornellians, if there's a Cornell Alumni Association or a Cornell Club in your local area, I encourage you to get involved in those programs as well. It's a great way to stay connected to the campus while your son and daughter is here. Yes, ma'am.
The subject of sexual attacks on campuses is rampant.
Okay.
What is Cornell doing in terms of educating the students?
So the question has to do with sexual violence on campus, sexual assault. There isn't a day that goes by that there isn't some article in some newspaper about it. So we're doing a whole host of things. One of the required programs that all of your students will go to is called Speak About It, and it's a an acting-based activity done by recent grads of a college talking about consent. What is consent? What is sexual assault? And so that will be a program they must go through. They will then have follow-up discussions in their residence halls. So we have an introductory program in our first year. Students, all the faculty and staff have an educational program that we go through as well. We partner with some key student groups. Our Women's Resource Center is one. We have a very active Men Against Sexual Violence group on campus that is students, faculty, and staff. We're increasingly trying to help our students become what we call active bystanders. And one program that we have for men is called Wingman 101. And so we teach them, and they teach each other how to look out for one another. We also have a great program that our students created called Cayuga's Watchers, that are students who are trained in active bystander, both about alcohol abuse and preventing sexual violence. So they go to parties, they stay sober, they see an interaction that's looking like it's going to go in a direction that it shouldn't, and they figure out how to intervene in a non-confrontational way to break things up. Another one of our councils that we have is the Council on Sexual Violence Prevention that the Vice President for Human Resources and Safety Services and I co-chair. So we're doing research in the area. We're trying to do some advocacy in the area. We're doing a lot of education required for all new students, and we're still in the development of what's going to be our sequence for our continuing students. We do it through Greek life, through athletics and others, but how do we make sure that all of our sophomores, juniors, and seniors continue to get in that education? That's another one of those topics that, as moms and dads, I hope you've started the conversation. If we're the ones that are starting it, it's a challenge. So, what is consent? What is not consent? Basically, if it's not expressed, there's no consent. That's the position that we take. But it's a tough topic. There's a lot of work that we need to do. And we have very well trained folks on the police. We have a victim advocate in our Gannett Health Center. So if someone is a victim of sexual violence, there's an advocate for that person. One of the challenges is that the legal system is a really tough one to go through because you have to prove beyond a reasonable doubt. And very often, the sexual violence that has occurred is between two people by themselves in a room. And so it's a real challenge, and yet something very wrong happened. And so we end up with a huge responsibility of keeping the campus safe. Yes, ma'am.
There's a lot of numbers and resources. I'm wondering if my daughter's confused by who to call. Is there a place to call to find out who to call?
So typical Cornell fashion, we give you lots of options. And where do I start? So two places. That's a great question. I'm walking around with this card in my hand. We have these on the outside. We're going to give these to all of our students. This is a shared website, particularly around sexual harassment and assault response in education. But it has key numbers on the back. On the back of their ID card are also 24/7 numbers. So it's the police. This one happens to be specific around sexual assault, but it's the police, Gannett Health Center,
are probably the two key ones. And there isn't a bathroom you can go into on campus that doesn't have key phone numbers right there. We will encourage the students, I hope it will happen tonight. You know, from my point of view, the police is an absolutely critical number. That's an emergency number, along with Gannett Health Service. They should have their RA's number and maybe their residence hall director number. If they're confused and they don't know where to go, living on North Campus, there's a wonderful resource called the Carol Tatkun Center. It's right in Balch. You may have seen it as you walked by today. That's a freshman resource center. It's open many hours of the week and into the evening, and staffed by professional staff, but in the evening hours by students. So if they can't find their RA, and that's a great resource, when in doubt, go to the Tatkun Center. But they'll have emergency numbers on the back of their ID card. And then I would say the other key resource would be their college advising office. That would be, you know, when in doubt, probably where I would go as a freshman if I had questions. Yes, ma'am.
This kind of relates to that safety issue.
Mm-hmm. So the question has to do with, we're a spread out campus, particularly if they're living on North Campus and in their libraries, what do you do in the evening? So there are several things. We have a blue light escort service that is students. We encourage students to do that, and they can just call and say they want to be walked home. I think probably what happens more often than not is friends decide they're going to walk back to the residence halls together. You know, we're done at 1 o'clock in the morning, let's walk back together, meet in front of the library, and let's go. If you're in a group of two or three, you're fine. You'll be fine walking. I wouldn't walk by myself, but I just don't like walking in the dark by myself, and it's probably just a smart thing not to do it. There are blue lights all over the campus. That's an emergency phone number, so if they find themselves by themselves and something's awry, they just pick up the phone, that goes right to the police. So, you know, mostly they're walking with friends. There is a bus, the blue light bus service that runs until 1 o'clock in the morning, I think. It goes, and that's for free for them. They're free all as first-year students, but for all students, that late-night bus is free as well. So friends, the bus, the escort service would be the things that I would recommend. Yes, ma'am.
How do they call the escort service?
How do they call the escort service? They'll get the number. I'll have to figure out how that... It's one of the resources that we have available. I don't know the number off the top of my head, but that's...
It's not on the card.
It's not on the card, because it's not a 24-7 number. The ones that we put on the card are the 24-7 numbers. Let's take another question or two. Yes. Yep. Okay, go ahead.
Thank you so much for having this open forum at the end of your lecture. It was wonderful. And you are making us all feel so welcome. I have two strikes against me. Originally from the West Coast, but went to school in Utica College, was brought up in Rochester. My first question is, how does a campus handle snow management in the wintertime, please? And I do have another second question, please.
Okay.
The second strike against me is, I'm from Boston area. Both my daughter, who now attends Northeastern University in Boston, and my son are, of course, children of the 9/11 era. Recently, second strike, we went through the Boston Marathon bombing. How does the campus here, please, handle emergency planning, dissemination of information, and that sort of thing? Thank you so much.
Two excellent questions. So, snow management. We handle it miraculously, quite frankly. We have unbelievable staff. I have my two grandkids live in Washington, D.C. If they see a flake, school's canceled. Last year, we delayed opening one day for 2 hours. We have an incredible grounds crew that runs through the night. I have the privilege of being on a phone call about 3 o'clock in the morning if we have a heavy snowstorm to decide whether we're safe to open in the morning. And what's safe to open in the morning are the parking lots plowed so we can get the workers in, and are the sidewalks plowed so that students can walk. If you are not from Rochester, if you're from Florida or Puerto Rico, don't go buying boots down there for here. You need to buy boots here.
Because even though they do a fabulous job, it gets icy and slippery. They're going to want a hat. They'll think, oh my gosh, you're going to make me wear a hat. They're going to want a hat. We sell funky wool hats. You want a hat here, it gets cold, as you know. We've never closed because of cold. Some places have places that close because of cold. We never do that. We just tell them to bundle up some more. But we may occasionally close for school, for snow. I'm the person that hates to have that happen because we have them living here anyway, so I just assume have them be productive in class. But if we can't get the faculty in or the staff in, then occasionally we will close, and then they just have to figure out how to make up the work. And we will push that message out, and they can keep track of it on a special conditions page, but when we close, we make that very well known across the campus. Your second question is an excellent one, and I'm glad you asked because I didn't mention it. It's about how do we deal with emergency, and I'm going to call emergency alert and emergency contact. I'm going to put those as two different categories. So emergency contact is the numbers that I hope your sons and daughters have given us of how to get you or somebody in your family if something does happen to them. There's a place for them to put the emergency contact information on their health form, but also in the information system. So they fall and break their leg, and we want to contact the parent. I don't want a Mickey Mouse phone number, and sometimes we get Mickey Mouse. So ask them, please, to make sure that's serious. We also ask them to sign up for an alert. So we push out text messages. We have sirens. We have a variety of ways. We test our alert system every semester so that if we need to have an alert to get in touch with people, because there's an active shooter or there's something that is going on, we have the mechanism to do that. And they need to sign up. They need to activate that, but they all should do that. So we have a very active emergency planning group. We have a staff in environmental health and safety and our police force together with our staff and student services. So we do all kinds of preparation for different kinds of emergencies, whether it's been H1N1 or something in the water system or active shooter or whatever it might be, fire. So that's all part of our training process. So in that sense, we're a little city. With 22,000 people who are here and 10,000 who work, it's important for us to do that. And you should feel confident. Your police are highly, highly trained. They do carry weapons. I can think of once when they've had to discharge that in my 35 years here. But frankly, I would just as soon have them have that capability if we need it. I'm just glad we don't have students who have the ability to have guns. Okay. Any one last question? These share cards will be on the way out. I'm delighted to stay for a few minutes if anybody has individual questions. Welcome to Cornell. Thank you.